This is the NPR News Update on a soggy Thursday, June 19th. I'm Phil Picardi. On the podcast, all that water will seep into the aquifer eventually. Minsure has a lot of work to do to get ready for open enrollment in the fall. More concern about a speech by the head of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department. Somalis worry about sending money to their homeland. It costs a lot to rent in the Twin Cities. Cars to go in St. Paul, and film music is on tap for the Minnesota Orchestra. First, more thunderstorms have moved across the state today. Heavy rain has prompted flood and flash flood warnings. A hailstorm earlier this week damaged crops worth an estimated $60 million in southwestern Minnesota's Rock County. Mark Stile reports.
The hail was part of a punishing storm system that also dropped flooding rains. Fraser Norton with the U.S. Agriculture Department in Rock County toured the area and estimates about 100,000 acres of corn and soybeans received moderate to severe hail damage. That's 40% of the arable acres in the county.
In places, you can't even tell what crop was planted there before. You don't know whether it was corn or soybeans. It's been damaged to that extent.
Norton says it's possible some of the less heavily damaged fields may yet survive and produce a crop this fall. He says flash flooding also damaged corn and soybean fields. Some parts of Rock County have received nearly a foot of rain in the past week. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Worthington.
All the rain has lakes and rivers rising, but does the rain mean the problem with declining groundwater levels has been solved? Kathy Werzer talked about that with Jim Stark. He is the director of the U.S. Geological Survey in Minnesota.
Well, let's start with maybe a little bit of here, some physics, I guess. Where does the rain water go? Does most of it stay in Minnesota, or is it just going to flow downriver?
Well, the rain just continues, and these events throughout the state are really, really very unusual for us to have this amount of rain throughout the state of Minnesota. We have record stream flows in many of our streams across the state. We have record levels in lakes throughout Minnesota. All of this water eventually flows out of the state. But that being said, there are many problems associated with the rainfall that we're now having. Some of that water infiltrates into our aquifers, and our shallow aquifers are responding. They're up several feet in many cases, and that is really a good thing for our groundwater systems, but maybe we're having too much of a good thing right now. Many of our fields are flooded, our soils are saturated, and it's affecting the growth of our crops.
So obviously good and bad, and since we've been reporting a lot on Minnesota's groundwater, does this now mean that the groundwater problem has been solved?
No, it doesn't. Our aquifers, our shallow aquifers, are responding. Those water levels are up. Our deeper aquifers, which we call our confined aquifers, respond more slowly. And there's a lag time between the responses in those deeper systems. So while our shallow aquifers are recharging, we still continue to be concerned about groundwater in many parts of the state, White Bear Lake being one. White Bear Lake is responding. It's up a couple of feet from its low. But these events that we have going on right now really are temporary with respect to our major groundwater systems. And we'll continue to be concerned about sustainability in those aquifers on the long term.
So you mentioned White Bear Lake, and it's good news that that lake is up, you mentioned a couple of feet because it's been so darn low. But does it bolster the argument that the problems with White Bear Lake are not because of overpumping, but just a lack of rain?
And the evidence, and this is still debatable, but the evidence that we have suggests that there are a couple of things going on there. One, although precipitation throughout the state is heavy this spring and has been increasing actually for many years, we haven't had a major drought since 1988, local periods of a lack of precipitation coupled with the water that we pump for our own use really are the two things that seem to have combined to have affected White Bear Lake.
Can I get back to the deeper aquifers for just a moment? And that obviously does affect White Bear Lake too, but how long does it take to recharge those deep aquifers?
Well, that recharge is slow, and it responds over long periods of time, years to decades. So these events that we see now won't be noticeable in those deep rock for some time, and that's really damped out, and there's a lag time of years to affect water levels significantly in those deeper systems. It depends on the depths of the systems and their connection with the land surface, but years to decades.
So because of increased development pressure, say, in the Twin Cities, then does that make conservation of existing water maybe beneficial?
In those areas around the state that are of concern with respect to water sustainability, conservation is one of the things that we need to put at the forefront.
Jim Stark, thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Jim Stark of the U.S. Geological Survey and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has begun taking comments on its proposed rules on carbon emissions. Elizabeth Dunbar reports.
Minnesota officials say they'll work over the next several months to analyze the EPA carbon reduction target for the state and send the agency feedback. The EPA wants to reduce overall carbon emissions 30% by 2030, but there are many variations between states. Under the proposed rule, Minnesota could have to reduce emissions by 40%. David Thornton is an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
If you look at the national picture, our target looks more aggressive than 30%, and it's more aggressive than our neighboring states. And so we're going to be looking into whether that's fair.
Thornton's comments came before the State Environmental Quality Board. Several citizens who spoke at the meeting argued Minnesota should strive to reduce emissions even more aggressively than the EPA target. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Undergraduate tuition at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities will stay flat for a second year in a row. Here's Alex Friedrich.
Next year's freeze is part of a $1.9 billion budget that trustees have approved. The freeze was part of a financial deal with the governor and the legislature. While undergraduate rates stay flat, Chief Financial Officer Laura King says graduate tuition will go up an average of 3%.
We haven't had particularly focused discussions around graduate tuition. We've really been focused on undergraduate, which is where the vast majority of our students are.
Student fee increases will average less than 0.5%, and room and board charges will rise an average of 3%. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
MinSure's new general contractor says the state's health insurance exchange faces major challenges in meeting the federal health care law's requirements for open enrollment this fall. The Deloitte Consulting Report says it's unclear MinSure can be ready when the next sign-up period begins in mid-November. Elizabeth Stawicki talked details with Tom Cran on All Things Considered.
So remind us first who Deloitte is and what they're doing here with MinSure.
Well, MinSure hired Deloitte Consulting in April for just about $5 million. They were also MinSure's first choice to be the original general contractor 2 years ago, but they came in about $20 million over budget, and so that went to another firm, Maximus. Now, what Deloitte is doing here is a couple of things. One is kind of a short-term assessment. What is MinSure kind of, how is it working and not working now? And then also looking long-term, how might MinSure work in years to come?
And what kind of shape is Deloitte saying MinSure is in?
Well, Deloitte's Brian Keene said that if you look at this kind of as a house, the blueprints look sound, but the house and the building and the particular rooms need a lot of work.
All right.
Specifically, two-thirds of MinSure's components or functions either don't work properly or are non-existent. The report says MinSure must make 41 components work for the fall open enrollment period, either through changes or manual workarounds.
Elizabeth, I think a lot of people hearing that might say two-thirds of necessary functions don't work. That sounds like a serious group of problems.
Well, a litany of problems, yes, but two major shortcomings emerge. One is that MinSure can't change a person's file after a change in their life, say they have a baby, they move, they lose a job, get divorced. And the other is what's coming up this fall, and that is renewal. You know, people can't renew coverage for commercial coverage as well as government-sponsored health programs such as medical assistance and Minnesota Care. And keep in mind, MinSure's original base of enrollments now numbers nearly a quarter of a million people.
So what happens if those functions don't work?
Errors, in a word. That ranges from the kinds of coverage Minnesotans are eligible for. It can jeopardize payment accuracy and medical assistance. There can be duplicate cases and applicants maybe not even receiving coverage or overpaying. On the renewal front, keep in mind, this is new, and this is adding a critical new function that will put more demands on a system that's already struggling.
Now, at the beginning, MinSure had all kinds of management problems. There's been some new management since the end of last year.
Right.
And what did this report have to say about that?
Well, Deloitte found that despite improvements, that program governance and the way that they are doing processes, you know, still remains diluted, which they said, which is impeding MinSure's progress. For example, MinSure still has problems tracking system defects and testing.
So the big question a lot of people have, can any of this be fixed in time for November?
Well, it depends, and it depends on numerous things. One is the commitment by vendors to make this happen and do it on time, the state's ability to prioritize what it needs, the amount of resources available, and then if those don't work, some contingency plans such as manual workarounds. Now, Deloitte's Brian Keene said he wished he could say everything was on track for November 15th, but from his experience, he said that would be poor of them to start planning that all of this will work and that there should be a heavy reliance on manual workarounds.
So what happens next here?
Well, Deloitte has outlined a roadmap to help the state be ready for open enrollment in the fall. And the state and Deloitte are in discussions to expand Deloitte's role.
Elizabeth Stawicki, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Tom.
Elizabeth and Tom Cran on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Minneapolis Civil Rights Director Velma Korbel could face discipline over a speech she made to employees last year. Several city council members recently received the text of that speech, which they described as shocking and disturbing. Yesterday, the president of the city council made it clear she shares those concerns. Curtis Gilbert reports.
The document was uncovered as part of a lawsuit the city recently settled for $38,000. The speech was directed at unhappy employees, who Korbel said were undermining morale in the department. In her remarks, delivered about a year ago at a staff meeting, she said those workers risked losing their jobs and would have difficulty finding new ones. Korbel noted her senior managers, quote, know a lot of people in the metro. The ones they don't know, she said, I know. It was one of several parts of the speech typed in all capital letters. City Council President Barbara Johnson.
And I apologize on behalf of the city to our employees who felt that their careers were threatened, both within the city and in general if they left the city.
At the meeting of the City Council's Executive Committee, Johnson also asked the city attorney about the process for disciplining department heads. The committee has the authority to suspend them without pay for 5 days. Longer suspensions need additional approval from the full city council. The council also has the power to fire department heads if first authorized by the 5-member executive committee, which is chaired by the mayor. Johnson didn't push for action, citing an independent review of the Civil Rights Department currently underway. But she says the issue is very much alive.
I really want to say I will wait for the consultant's report, but I am extremely disappointed in what I have heard and read, and I'm not closing any doors today.
Johnson supported Korbel through a bruising confirmation process earlier this year. At a public hearing, two former employees and the head of the union representing them raised concerns about Korbel's management style. In the end, Korbel survived, but 3 first-term council members voted against her. In spite of the new controversy, Mayor Betsy Hodges continues to support Korbel.
I have confidence that she can lead the department. You know, the issues that were raised during the process are issues that we are managing moving forward.
Hodges says she met with Korbel and discussed the speech with her, among other issues. Korbel also sparked controversy recently when she publicly criticized City Council member Blong Yang. Korbel, who is black, told a group of African-American activists she didn't think Yang, who's Hmong, knows he's, quote, supposed to represent the community. The Asian American Organizing Project calls that a racist remark and sent a letter to city leaders this week calling for Korbel's resignation. Yang sits on the organization's board, but its executive director says Yang wasn't involved in crafting the group's position on the issue. Korbel denied any racial undertones in her comment. City data show there have been two formal complaints against Korbel since she started working for Minneapolis in 2010. One complaint remains open. According to Korbel's personnel file, she's never been disciplined.
Curtis Gilbert in Minneapolis. After a quarter century of conflict, Somalia may be entering a new era of stability. Militants have been forced out of major population centers, and the U.S. could soon reopen its embassy in Mogadishu. But a crucial source of economic support may be cut off. As Matt Sepik reports, one of the last American banks transferring money from American Somalis to their relatives back home is getting out of the business.
At the Village Market, one of several Somali-American shopping malls in Minneapolis, you can get everything from clothing and rugs to a meal and a haircut. 28-year-old Goth Ali works at a cell phone shop here. He also goes to school, but says every month he still manages to scrape together $400 to $500 to send to his siblings in East Africa. Ali says his older brother, who lives in Somalia, struggles to feed his five children, even though he owns a small business.
It's not enough to provide his family. The money we send in Somalia is a lifeline.
Ali says when he gets paid, he uses a service known as a hawala to wire the cash to his family. There are several hawalas near the cell phone shop where Ali works. At one of these, North America Money Transfer, owner Shakir Hussein says running a hawala means abiding by a lot of ever-changing government regulations.
If somebody walks in right now, the first I require identification, even if you send him $50. I have to get identification.
The charity Oxfam says every year businesses like these help Somali Americans send more than $200 million to relatives. A total of $1.3 billion flows into Somalia from migrants around the globe. Oxfam says so-called remittances may account for as much as 40% of Somalia's entire economy. Dagan Ali, the executive director of the Nairobi-based nonprofit Adesso, says for many Somalis, money from relatives overseas can often make the difference between eating and starving.
Those households that usually tend to be the most vulnerable in Somalia are oftentimes the households who don't have a relative abroad who can send a regular remittance.
Hawalas need bank accounts to operate, but most American banks are reluctant to work with the money wiring firms because of tough federal laws aimed at thwarting money laundering and terrorist financing. Merchants Bank of California, one of the last American banks to work with hawalas, says it'll close their accounts late next month. Merchants Bank officials couldn't be reached for comment, but banking consultant Bert Ely says many bankers are afraid that any mistake in complying with government regulations could result in severe consequences.
There have been some banks, particularly large banks, that have been fined very significantly for violations in this area. And so the safe way to play it is just not to do the business.
On top of the financial threat looming over Somalia, there's a natural one. Lack of rainfall may lead to drought, then famine. Aid officials are worried about a potential repeat of a drought-related famine that killed more than a quarter million Somalis a few years ago. Jelani Hussein, a board member of the Twin Cities-based American Relief Agency for the Horn of Africa, says remittances were an enormous help during the 2011 famine. Hussein says it's urgent that Congress pass legislation aimed at making it easier for banks to handle remittance payments.
We're stopping people being able to send money that they were already going to send. We're talking about 200,000 people that are going to die because they don't have food. Imagine if we add another 1 million people who are expecting their daily income.
A bill from DFL Congressman Keith Ellison that passed the Republican-controlled House last month and is now in the Senate would let state bank examiners enforce some federal rules. Ellison has said the measure is designed to streamline regulation and could reduce banks' fear of working with hawalas. Hussein says if Somali Americans are able to continue sending money to relatives in need, aid organizations like his will be able to focus more time and energy on preventing a repeat of the last famine.
Matt Sepik there. The Twin Cities housing market continues to rebound. Demand for apartments is especially strong. And according to a new report, average monthly rents in the metro area are rising. While that's good news for developers and investors, one housing advocacy group says the boom is making it harder for people of limited means to find an affordable place to live. We go back to Matt Sepik.
The apartment boom, especially in Minneapolis, is obvious to anyone who's taken a glance at the skyline lately. The 36-story LPM Apartments is nearing completion just east of Loring Park. The building boasts amenities including a yoga area, game room, and indoor dog run that even includes a washing station for dogs. At 5th and Nicollet, the luxury high-rise Nick on 5th features a rooftop deck with a pool and bar. Basic studio apartments in these buildings rent for $1,400 to $1,600 a month. The most expensive will set you back around $5,000. There are also new high-end rentals in Dinkytown, the Uptown area, and in St. Paul. Chip Halbach, executive director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership, says apartment construction in the Twin Cities rose 70% in the last year. He says all the new luxury apartments on the market are just one reason that earlier this year, the average cost of a rental unit in the metro reached $1,000 a month for the first time. That's according to data from Marquette Advisors, a real estate consulting firm. He also says demand from young professionals, empty nesters, and people unable to qualify for a mortgage is also pushing prices up. Halbach says demand for less expensive market-rate apartments is strong, too, but the supply of those is shrinking.
The apartments around that rent for $650 a month or less, which is the really affordable stock, declined this last decade by one half. So you've lost some 70,000 apartments during that decade that were most affordable.
Halbach says that's because rents rose on existing apartments or the buildings and land were put to other uses. He says the vacancy rate for apartments under $1,000 a month is just 2.2%, meaning there are few choices for people whose wages aren't keeping up with the cost of living.
People just do not have the incomes to pay for the housing that's out there or the new market rate housing being created.
Halbach says statistics on homelessness bear that out. The number of homeless children in the Minneapolis Public School District is up 8% over last year. At the Naomi Family Center, a homeless shelter in downtown St. Paul, program director Pat Watkins says she sees the effects of the housing crunch firsthand. Watkins says about a dozen of the families who live at Naomi are awaiting placement in permanent housing. She says Naomi's Housing Plus transitional program was set up for 30 to 60 day stays, just long enough to find an apartment and move in. But Watkins says today, people tend to stay at Naomi much longer.
We have some that have stayed 90 days. We have some that have stayed 100 days, you know, and that's because it's been hard for them to find housing.
Naomi Center case manager Peggy Krause says there's such high demand for affordable housing that the Twin Cities Housing and Redevelopment Authority stopped accepting new applications for Section 8 rental vouchers years ago.
The list is so long from applications they got all those years ago that people are still on the list waiting for them.
The HRA says there's a 5 to 7 year waiting list to get a Section 8 voucher. However, housing advocates say Minnesota's elected officials have recognized the severity of the problem. This year, state lawmakers and Governor Mark Dayton approved a bonding bill that includes $100 million for affordable housing projects across the state. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A popular car-sharing company in Minneapolis is about to move downriver. The St. Paul City Council has approved a deal with German company Car2Go to park smart cars on St. Paul streets. Peter Cox reports.
To use a car-sharing service, all you have to do is find a car on your smartphone, swipe your membership card on the windshield, and the car says,
"Hello and welcome to Car2Go."
In July, Car2Go will put a fleet of 185 cars onto St. Paul streets. Under the agreement approved by the St. Paul City Council, Car2Go will pay the city $975 per car annually, around $180,000. That fee pays for parking spots taken by the vehicles, as well as administrative fees. The council can change that fee after the first year, based on the actual parking charges.
We've been kind of chomping at the bit to be able to get this up and running.
Josh Johnson manages Car2Go in the Twin Cities.
Allowing crossover between the two cities is very exciting for us.
Car2Go has a fleet of 350 vehicles in Minneapolis. Potential Car2Go user Teresa Kane, who lives just across the bridge in West St. Paul, urged the council to make the deal.
If I leave this meeting and I have a half an hour to wait for another bus, which is an 8-minute ride for me, I would have taken a Car2Go if it was available.
Kane, who also works for Metro Transit, says car sharing programs can help supplement the existing public transportation system. Councilman Dai Tao says he spoke to many constituent groups who weren't aware of the agreement. He said there should be more community meetings about the deal before a vote.
I like Car2Go. I think it's a great idea. It's a great concept. But the way we're getting to it, I think it's wrong. We have a responsibility to slow things down.
Councilman Dan Bostrom worried that vehicles could end up sitting at meters all day.
What we're doing is turning the right-of-way over basically for private industry. I don't see this coming out well for the city.
But Councilwoman Amy Brenmoan said the kinks of the deal have been worked out in Minneapolis.
And I think it's fortunate that they got trained in across the river, had an opportunity to work out the bugs. And I'm really convinced that our concerns about meter hogging or clustering are a little overblown because the business and the users of the service share our interest in keeping cars moving. That's when they make money.
In the end, the council approved the 18-month contract, 4-2. This summer, members may use a Car2Go between the two cities. A fleet team can relocate vehicles to even the balance between Minneapolis and St. Paul. According to a report released yesterday, Car2Go is growing. Membership in Minneapolis increased from around 6,000 in March to more than 8,000 in late May. The car-sharing service launched in Minneapolis last September. Director of Traffic and Parking Services John Wirtjes says there were a few small hiccups over the winter, but the contract has worked well for the city.
Our operations with Car2Go have gone pretty smoothly this year. I think they came into a new market, and I think they just had some subtleties in dealing with winter, but they seem to do well with that, and it looks like their growth is occurring in their business model.
Car2Go's Josh Johnson says the company is ready to roll out their fleet.
We actually have the cars sitting in a warehouse about 5 minutes outside of downtown, so they're ready and waiting for dispersal throughout the city.
Johnson expects the St. Paul program to start soon after July 1st.
That's Peter Cox. A Minnesotan behind some of the best-known animated films of recent years will be on stage this weekend with the Minnesota Orchestra. Bloomington native Pete Docter has worked on Pixar films almost since the studio's beginning, starting as an animator but rising to the director's chair. His credits include Toy Story, Monsters, Inc., and the movie for which he won an Oscar, Up. However, Docter told UNCARE his career is really rooted in music.
Pete Docter comes from a musical family. His parents led choirs in the Twin Cities. Both his sisters are professional classical musicians. One even played for the Minnesota Orchestra. So it would seem natural that Pete would play too, wouldn't it?
You know what? Basically, I couldn't stomach the practicing, is the sad truth of it. That's a lot of work. And so I would spend most of my time during concerts drawing on the programs. And that really is what I credit my getting into this to.
Docter has worked on almost all Pixar's 14 films so far. Now he's excited to be presenting a program of animation and live music at Orchestra Hall.
Well, it's really fun because we have footage from the film, or films, actually, and then also, of course, the reason you go is the live orchestra, fantastic orchestra playing along to the picture.
Pixar edited excerpts from the films for the orchestral program. The Minnesota Orchestra will provide the accompaniment to such movies as Ratatouille, Wall-E, Monsters, Inc., and Brave. While Docter may have spent his childhood doodling during concerts, he loves the music. And working on a film score is clearly a high point for him.
I mean, that's one of the great pleasures for me as a director, is getting to the end of the process where we finally go to the recording studio and sit down with a 110-piece orchestra and hear this just come to life. It's amazing.
Docter will talk about the role of music in movies during the concerts on Saturday and Sunday. He says movie composers become storytellers. He gives an example from Up, a theme used early in the movie to illustrate the marriage of the movie's grumpy protagonist, Carl, and his wife Ellie, returns for a very different reason.
You know, that theme that you hear at the beginning of the film that has to do with Carl and Ellie's relationship, that's used later on in the film in an action cue way. So that you're bringing to mind the character of Ellie, even though she's not on the screen. And that's what I mean by storytelling, that the composers are really partnering with us in talking about the internal emotional life of the characters that you're seeing.
Pete Docter talks about the vital role that timing plays in both animation and music. For him, the two are firmly entwined.
As an animator, say on Toy Story when I was doing a lot of animation, I would time things out by hearing it in my head. You know, a character falling down the stairs, bum, ba-dum, 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 you know, and so I'd kind of time it out with a stopwatch based on what I heard and then create visuals to go with that.
Pete Docter played violin and bass when he was young. He got a kick out of playing a few notes during the recording of the Up soundtrack. He won't be doing that this weekend with the Minnesota Orchestra. Too intimidating, he says. However, he might well take his sketchbook on stage during the concert.
You don't think the musicians will get upset?
Well, they might be surprised how many other kids are doodling in the audience as well. I don't know.
And who knows how many of them will go on to be Academy Award-winning animators. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. John Wanamaker will have the Friday news right back here tomorrow.